In this program, we interview Arthur Haynes. Now, Arthur grew up in the western mountains of Maine, where he spent most of his childhood in the Sandy River Valley, hiking, trekking, and foraging. Arthur has taken that lifetime's worth of skills and put them to use in the Delta Institute of Natural History, where he teaches people the value of foraging, wildcraft medicines, and primitive living skills. So let's join Arthur and Alan in the studio now and learn all about finding our food in nature.
Good morning, Arthur and Mark.
Good morning.
I asked you to be on the show because I really was impressed by your presentation when I met you at the Paleo FX 2014 at Austin. And your presentation was about hunter-gatherer diets. And as a city boy myself, I was intrigued about your subject. Can you explain what a hunter-gatherer diet is?
Well, a hunter-gatherer diet would be the diet that is followed by indigenous people. In other words, it would be the wild plants, animals, fungi, or even the wild bacteria that they use in fermentation as part of their whole dietary practice. And of course, that diet varies from place to place in terms of the particular species that they consume. But one of the points that I was presenting at the PaleoFX conference that you mentioned is that despite the local differences in the species consumed, there were still overriding similarities amongst all of those particular diets.
Right, right. Can you, for people that are not so aware, can you explain what is your process and how you go about it?
Well, in terms of just actually gathering food on a day-to-day basis, a lot of what we're gathering, particularly through the growing season, are wild plants. And learning which species are edible or medicinal or can be used for some type of utilitarian purpose is just a matter of studying the plants, which sometimes includes studying the ethnobotanical literature. In other words, how people interact. For us, we have our favorite places that we visit, and these will change through the year. And then, of course, it depends on what we're going after. This time of year, we're in the spring of the year, and there are lots of new leaves and shoots that are emerging from the ground. So things like fiddleheads and stinging nettles, wood nettles, spring beauties, these are all species of plants that send up young leaves and shoots that are tender, and they're great to be used in salads and sautés and those kinds of things. But if you were to come here later in the year, we wouldn't be gathering those things because they would be too tough or too bitter tasting. They would have aspects about them that just wouldn't make them a good food. Almost like if you were to let lettuce just go way too long in your garden, it might turn into something you don't want to eat. And we would be instead gathering things like raspberries, blackberries, or potentially shadbush, which gets called Saskatoon in the West. So really that process of what we go about doing on a day-to-day basis is very much dependent on the time of year and also where we are, because each habitat type, each assemblage of plants on the landscapes offers different foods. So it really requires, in order to put this together into a substantial diet plan where you can get a lot from the landscape, it requires a lot of knowledge. But of course, that's not to scare anybody off, because I like to think of each plant as having its own skill set. So you can, in fact, learn a little bit about this plant, that plant, and that plant, and have a few that you figure out how to incorporate into your diet.
What percentage of your food typically are you able to gather on, just sustainable way, I guess?
It really changes literally every day and even every meal. And it's a question that I get asked a lot, and it's a hard one for me to provide a concrete answer for. We have whole meals that will be nothing but wild foods, and these might be things like, recently, for example, one of our great wild meals was venison that we cooked outside on an open fire that we had marinated for the day in kind of a nice dressing to spice it up a little bit. Fiddleheads, which we had boiled, and then a beautiful wild salad with spring beauty greens. And, you know, other days we may have very little wild food, particularly when we're traveling, because that's a lot harder to procure, you know, when you're busy driving in the car, presenting and teaching various places. Right. What I can say is we gather enough wild food through the year that we can consume it every day of the year. So even over our long winter period, which is almost 6 months out of the growing season for us, here in this part of the world, we have staples that we gather that can be dried, like acorns and wild rice. Many people think that wild rice is sort of a product of the Great Lakes region, and in fact, a lot of the northeastern and eastern states have large stands of wild rice that can be gathered. So these are things that we would combine with the foods that we get from our farmers markets and local farms that we visit. You know, some parts of the year, our diet is between 25 and 50% wild. During the winter season, that tends to drop a bit because we don't have access to the wide array of plant foods that we do, you know, obviously during the growing season. We're fortunate to live in the part of the world that we do. Maine has a wonderful seafood tradition, and between fish, shellfish, and crustaceans, we're also able to buy fresh seafood that's off the dock, you know, that morning, and we incorporate as much of that as we can into our diet because these are some of the wild foods that are available, you know, for purchase.
That sounds great. How much of that are you able to preserve or dry for the winter season, typically?
Yeah, a fair amount. But normally what we are preserving, you know, there's only a few kinds of foods that will preserve well, and we tend to use drying. Living where we do, off the grid in a solar-powered home, we don't have, you know, infinite amounts of energy coming into the house. It's just what we generate through our solar arrays. So rather than using extensive freezing, which would cost us tremendously in energy, we tend to do a lot of sun drying. And things that lend themselves well to that are certainly some of the berries and other fleshy fruits that we gather, chokecherry, shadbush, and other fruits, where we'll press them out into pans and dry them in the sun to make a type of fruit leather. Acorns dry very well and can be kept for years, and we dry them in the shell and then process them as we need them. And then wild rice as well is something that we dry out on big tarps, and we'll be drying 40 or 50 pounds at a time, depending on how much we were able to gather by canoe that day. And once dried, we store it in sacks and process it through the year as we need it. So those are some of the plant foods that do store well. A lot of the things that we're eating this time of year, the leaves, the shoots, and things of that nature, we do ferment occasionally so that we can have them for a longer period of time. But for long-term storage, we freeze a little, but they're just not nearly as good once frozen. And so we like them so much fresh, we tend to just enjoy them this time of year.
Do you find drying easier to work with than preserving or canning?
Well, the canning is relatively easy, and we do can some foods, but those particular foods, you know, the plant foods get really sort of destroyed by the canning. They are cooked so long, at least those that I'm gathering, to make clear that we just don't like them as much that way. But the meats, the wild meats that we have access to, particularly white-tailed deer, which is one of the real sort of high-value foods that we can get in our forests in this part of the world, that once canned is this wonderful tender meat that we'll use in hot cereals, in soups, and even for dinners and that kind of thing. So we tend to can meat much more than we can plant foods. Mm-hmm. And that is partly just based on the kinds of foods that we're gathering.
Yeah, I realized that drying food will preserve the nutrients and the enzymes whereby canning would destroy that, yes. How much time do you spend hunting and gathering?
Well, again, that changes through the year, but this time of year where we have a lot of plants that we can go out for, it's really wonderful because we buy very few from the supermarket, maybe just a few things that are hard to get this time of year, some nuts or something like that to accompany our food. But essentially, we're using a lot of our free time. So after, you know, after the workday, during weekends, holidays, our vacations. I mean, we spend often doing these types of activities. So we've really tried to build it into our life. We feel this type of food sovereignty is something that the whole family should be doing. We're doing this with our infant daughter right now, as opposed to, you know, constantly doing other kinds of events. We want to make sure that this is an integrated skill that she has. So, yeah, essentially, most of our free time, we spend doing this kind of activity. I think it has a lot of benefits, even beyond the nutrition and the self-reliance, just a connection to the landscape, an understanding where food can come from. And, of course, while you're out there foraging, you're getting exposure to the elements, you know, sunlight for vitamin D production, clean air, all of those sorts of things that are these secondary benefits of foraging.
Yeah, you look like a very healthy fellow to me.
I try. I do my best.
Yeah, all that fresh air and vitamin D and good quality fresh food is doing you and your family a lot of good. So, in effect, you're really actually living the original paleo diet, the hunter-gatherer diet.
Yeah, that's our goal. And our goal is not to necessarily replicate any diet, any one diet, or to be considered part of we belong to this diet or that diet. It's really, you know, stems back to a lot of anthropological studies that have examined the health of indigenous groups and realized that they lived these relatively long, healthy lives free of chronic disease. And, well, we want that. And all of those people were consuming wild food. Of course, if you look at the writings of Weston Price, he did examine some isolated traditional cultures who were using cultivated foods or domesticated foods. In other words, you know, certain types of animals that they had domesticated as part of that. But all of the groups that he examined had certainly one thing in common, and that is that wild food compose some portion of the diet, and we're trying to do the best that we can for our health, but also we consider that for the health of the landscape. You know, organic gardening is certainly a major step above conventionally raised produce because of all of the things that it doesn't use, but certainly leaving the forest completely intact and foraging obviously in a conscientious manner, in a way that can be sustained for generations, is, I would politely argue, even a step above organic agriculture in terms of its impact on the land.
Right. I absolutely agree with you, but it's not always accessible to the average person out there. Yeah.
And so what I try to propose is that for the people that do have access to it, and I think it's about 50% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas, you know, those are people that can do some of this kind of food procurement. We can't all do it. Certainly, we have too large a population, and I understand that. But we can do a lot more than we do. There's a lot of food that can be gathered, particularly once people learn how to do it in a sustainable manner.
Right. We probably already addressed this question, but can you tell us why you're doing it?
Sure. We've talked certainly a little bit about some of the reasons that we do it, that exposure to the elements. We just really enjoy being outside this time of year with all of the spring bird migrants back. It's just a symphony in the morning and in the evening with all the bird song. It's just really a beautiful time to be outside. But a big part of the reason that we do it is in fact for the nutrition, and we can go into whatever level of detail you have time for here, but to sum it up, what's been realized in a lot of independent studies that have gone on is wild foods on average are more nutrient dense than the foods that we cultivate. They have a higher level of phytochemistry because essentially we haven't bred these plant compounds out of them, so they have higher antioxidant values, stronger anti-cancer compounds or anti-inflammatory compounds, and we could go on at length talking about those kinds of things. They tend to have more fiber and less sugars and those sort of simple carbohydrates. And the last thing is a more beneficial ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids than a lot of the cultivated produce that we eat. And so when you add all that up, you get this greater nutritional package from those wild foods. And of course, when I say that, that is not to mean that organic produce isn't deeply nutritious, because we all know that it is. Those are healing foods in and of themselves. But what I'm trying to do with a lot of the teaching that I do is to show that we shouldn't necessarily consider organic produce to be the top of the mountain. It's just very close to the top of the mountain, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Speaking of which, I understand you teach classes about foraging. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, one of the things that I really enjoy doing is sort of opening up people's eyes to what they generally see as a wall of green. We don't learn a lot about botany in our schooling today, particularly our public schooling. And so when people look out onto the landscape, they see green, which is wonderful, but they don't necessarily know the different parts of green. In other words, the individual plant species that make up that landscape that they're looking at. And some of those individual plants are wonderful healing foods. They are powerful medicines, or they can be used to make things that we can use in our foraging and in our wildcrafting of medicine. And so a big part of what I like to do is just to open people's eyes up to the possibilities of what they can do with their wild landscapes, in large part for the self-reliance that it offers, but also for the nutrition. And as well, I'm trying to make a connection to the landscape with people so that they understand that every patch of forest that we cut down is essentially a lost opportunity for foraging and other wild activities. So I run classes that might just be an afternoon, or some of them are weekend-long immersions in wild food, and I do them here at my home at the Delta Institute of Natural History here in Canton, Maine.
I heard a term in your presentation that was intriguing to me, wild crafting. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, wild crafting is a term that has been used for a while now that simply refers to the gathering of plants for whatever purpose, food, medicine, or other uses from the landscape. And so we like to think of, you know, agriculture has, you know, organic agriculture, which we could obviously subdivide further because there are different methods of that. And we have conventional agriculture. We have other things that we might describe as permaculture. And wildcrafting is just a way of talking about the wild foods that we gather that were not cultivated, that were growing wild on the landscape.
You know, I guess it's a very vast subject, but maybe you can give us a few tips on what to look for that would be easily accessible if we were to walk out there in the wild, some plants or edible flowers or...
Right. Well, it is. That's a hard question because it varies so much depending on what part of the world people are coming from and even what time of year. But, you know, many people are at least familiar with some of the weeds, and this is one of the reasons why people bring up things like dandelion and plantain and some of these other low-growing herbaceous plants that are found really anywhere that people have, you know, built civilization and built towns, because they're species that are capable of utilizing human disturbed habitats. And though these plants are some of the most nutritious wild plant foods out there, they're not necessarily the best tasting foods. The dandelion has a bit of bitterness. The plantain has a slightly tougher leaf, particularly later in the season. And so what I'm often trying to get people to do is go berry picking. And there are lots of places, again, if you're living in a rural landscape, where you can go out and gather things like strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, and blackberries. And to keep in mind that they're largely familiar with these plants already, because the store-purchased forms are so similar to the wild forms in their morphology, in their taste. In other words, if you're eating something that you think is a blackberry and it doesn't taste like what you had in the store at all, well, you probably should stop consuming that wild plant. But if they're going out after some of these wild berries, they're probably already familiar with them. And that way they already have a connection to these foods, and they're going to know how to bring them into their diet, whether they're using them in baking or in salads or just enjoying them on their own. So I actually direct people to some of these foods that I know they're going to enjoy the taste of. The last thing I want to do is to direct people to a food that requires an adjusted palate. Mm-hmm. For example, many American cuisines are very lacking in bitters, which is very common in many wild plant foods. And so I don't want people getting turned off to them. So berries are something I try to send people out for as often as I can whenever their landscape allows it.
That reminds me, when I was a little kid living in Normandy, my brother and I would roam around and we would get wild blackberries and grapes, and if we were lucky we'd find wild strawberries. But it was kind of a hidden secret that we kept to ourselves. We didn't really want to share with everybody else, right? Do you find that you find the same?
Yeah, we share a lot trying to just sort of promote these nutritious foods, and sometimes that comes with a cost. Some of the places that we harvest from, some students will return to and use those as their locations. But what we're finding in general is because so few people recognize wild plants anymore, and we're seeing a greater and greater sort of divorcement from nature with modern people. My partner and I will pull up to a parking spot that goes down to a very popular swimming hole in the river that I grew up on. And this river is frequented by tens and sometimes more than that, many tens of people every day during the hot summer. And when you pull up to this spot, there's an entire bank of wild blackberries. And they're just there waiting for us. And even when we tell people that they're there, every year they're still just there waiting for us. People have become very accustomed to the convenience of getting packages of foods in the store that have either been picked by fossil fuel driven machines or migrant workers. And the real relaxing and enjoyable thing of gathering fruits is being lost on them because it seems like work to them. So, yeah, we find that we sometimes keep certain things secret. Other things we're free to share because at least right now in this point in time, a lot of people are not interested in doing the work of gathering or growing their own food, which is a real sad thing to me.
There's nothing better. I mean, I still have fresh memory that eating fresh strawberries picked warm from the sun. It's just a fantastic experience that is, will stay with me for the rest of my life.
I remember the same exact thing, picking cups of wild strawberries when I was a young kid. It was maybe the very first wild food that I was introduced to. And, I mean, we know that wild strawberries are smaller than the cultivated strawberries, but the flavor can't be beat.
No. Do you know, I've never managed to eat a wild strawberry.
No?
Well, the problem is when Patrick and I go out for walks, as my business partner, as we used to do quite a lot when we lived down in the Alps Maritime, he always used to sort of walk along the path first. And by the time I got there, they've gone.
Oh, you mean he's not sharing with you?
Well, he sort of shares the stalks, I suppose.
I was watching a French show on food the other day, and the host was actually talking to wild mushroom gatherers in France.
Yeah.
And it's actually a profession.
It is.
And they do go out during the proper season, they do go out and gather those very rare and very expensive mushrooms that only the top restaurant would use, and they resell them. But one thing that one person was complaining is that a lot more people are coming and basically hunting on their grounds, and stealing their livelihood because they go at any time, they're not respecting the environment, they step on them, they take away the mushrooms from them. So that may be why also some people are not willing to share, their foraging experience because they're afraid that too many people will come and take the food away from them.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that there's nothing that could be worse than being, you know, able to look forward to these wonderful wild foods and to have them completely stripped bare before you arrive at these locations that you've maybe been visiting potentially for decades as part of a family tradition. We do have some commercial collecting here in Maine. One of the big foods that for wild plants that are gathered in the spring of the year are the ostrich fern fiddleheads. And this is not to say that all commercial collectors are doing a bad job, because I've seen some that aren't. But many of them, the short-term economic gain is the only thing they're thinking about. And when these ferns come up in a coiled-up fiddlehead, they come up in a little circle of 3, 4, 5, maybe even 7 or 8 fiddleheads. And rather than being sure to leave half of those young curled-up leaves behind so that the plant can photosynthesize and essentially survive through the summer to produce new fiddleheads the next year, they're taking all of them. And by stripping the ground bare, they're essentially reducing the size of these populations every generation. So we're running into that. The one issue that I'm really trying to combat is, though, when we prevent people from learning this information, we're essentially continuing to maintain their isolation from nature, or at least from this really wonderful aspect of nature. So what I do is I'm presenting this information, but really trying to make sure that ethical harvesting, learning how to, with each individual plant, what are the techniques for making sure that we sustainably collect from these populations, is put out there as part of the teaching. And that's not always done. I think that's a really important thing that foraging instructors need to be sharing.
I've noticed in Austin, we also have a couple of people offering foraging classes, hunting and foraging classes. So it's a trend that seems to be expanding as well. And thank you and all people doing that for sharing your knowledge with the rest of us, especially silly boys like me that, I was partly raised on my grandmother's farm in Normandy, but I've forgotten most of it, and I couldn't tell one wild plant from another right now. I mean, even if I was starving, unfortunately.
But what's really neat is those experiences, even though the particulars of, say, the plant identification aren't with you, the experiences are still in your memory, and it seems like you're still carrying them in a very favorable way, which is one of the great things that I think when people interact with nature, whether that's growing food in their yard or foraging for that food in the forests that are near their home, there are these, I'll call them additional benefits that we don't always think about that come with those kinds of activities. And I think that's true also of cooking with fresh food.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. I find that very therapeutic.
The one I have a hard time wrapping my head around is stinging nettles. It's always been something I fear and not something I eat. Can you tell us how to handle it properly?
Yeah. We actually have here in the Northeast, we have two species of plants in that particular family, which is called the Urticaceae, the stinging nettle family. Two species of plants that have stinging hairs on them. And these hairs can be really annoying because they're these brittle hairs that break off at an angle so that they have a sharp point. They puncture your skin, and in doing so, they allow this irritating fluid that the plant produces to go under your skin. So it's sort of like a mildly burning itch. Not any fun if you were to be tossed into a patch of nettles, particularly late in the season. And the tricks are several. The easiest thing is to gather them very early in the season when they're only a couple of inches tall. They're a great wild food at that time, particularly stinging nettles, have these amazingly rich, very dark green leaves. You can just tell that they're bursting with nutrients when you look at them. And at that time, early in the year, the stinging hairs are still very flexible. So they simply can't penetrate the callus of your fingertips, unless, you know, people who might have extremely soft fingers, but then they could always wear a glove. But we gather nettles throughout a lot of the year, and stinging nettles are one of the plants that I really like to direct people to because they tolerate the collection so well. If you snap off or break off the tender tip growing portion of that, it will simply branch and continue to grow after that. In other words, it doesn't kill the plant in any way. Later in the year, of course, and we're talking about later into the summer when you go to gather these for tea plants or for food, now you're dealing with a really formidable plant. Those stinging hairs are dried, they're rigid, and they can jab you through your clothing, sometimes under your skin. So the real important thing here is to blend and flow with your landscape. In other words, you've got to move amongst them carefully and sort of let them dictate how you move around, not simply plow through as you might want to or as we can even do in our gardens. We have to be a lot more ginger about the way we move around in these patches of plants. But a lot of people will gather the later season plants wearing a thin glove, something they still have some dexterity with, and that will protect most people. What's really bad is when the plants get tall and you get touched, like up near your armpit, the inside of your arm. That's the absolute worst. But again, if you're being really aware and moving slowly, even later in the season, you can avoid getting stung up by them. And of course, just so that people are aware, if you dry stinging nettles, that being one of the leaves that we do dry a lot of for tea during the winter season, or if you cook them, all of those irritating compounds are completely diminished, so you just end up with this really delicious food. So it's only formidable in life when it's more mature.
So how do you cook them? Do you boil them? Do you saute them?
Any of those methods will work when we're cooking them, because we do have to, because they do have these stinging hairs. So it's not something that you can enjoy raw, really, except when they're extremely tiny. We like to steam them a lot. You know, steaming does a little bit better job not leaching out some of the nutrition, although with nettles, you can certainly consume that cooking water if you were to boil them as a tea, and you get a lot of the nutrition that you essentially leached out of the leaves. We love steaming so much because when we take our greens, you know, out of the cooking container, you don't have a large pile of water that ends up on your plate. So we tend to use steaming a lot, and it only takes just a couple of minutes of steaming to have this really wonderful food. What I love about stinging nettles, unlike some greens, is they don't collapse into a pile of mush as quickly. So they sort of keep their substance in their body, which just makes them really wonderful on the plate.
And I'll show you how little I know. Do you have to actually take the stings out before you cook them, or do you just throw them in the pot like this?
No, that's the nice thing, is the cooking simply softens all of those stinging hairs and you don't even notice them. I mean, even after a minute of cooking, they would be completely safe to consume. And when you dry them for, say, making tea or to even have the leaves to be able to put into soups or making pesto or whatever you'd like to do with them, the drying renders all of those irritating compounds completely inert as well. So heat does it and drying does it. So you don't have to worry about picking anything off, fortunately, because it would take forever. The plants are just coated top to bottom in these hairs. And I know it sounds really like, why would you bother with those? But any listener who might be having that comment, if you could see how easy it is, once you're familiar with the plant, to gather them. After a few times, you're an old pro at it. And if you enjoy greens and you got a chance to have these, particularly, you know, with your fat of choice, whether that was olive oil or butter or whatever that might be on them, they're just absolutely delicious.
Thank you. It sounds good. I'll let an expert deal with that.
Start with nettle soup, Alan. That's the best thing.
Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned something that sort of piqued my interest earlier. Wild foods aren't just for consuming, but you said they've got utilitarian uses as well. What might they be?
Well, there's a whole range of utilitarian purposes. And to give you a couple of examples, well, for one, we actually don't start our fires here with matches and lighters. We actually start our fires, whether that be an outdoor fire for grilling food or when we have company over at night, it's fun to sit around the fire, or the wood stove that's in our home, we start them with bow drills and hand drills. So these are friction fire methods that essentially have one stick that spins on a stationary piece of wood, and the friction eventually generates a little ember that we can use to start a fire. And we gather those plants that we use to start fires right here from our landscape. And when we're done, we can toss them back onto our landscape. No pollution, no long-distance transport, no refinement of fuels, those kinds of things. I'm not suggesting that everyone has to do that, but that's one of the approaches that we take. But maybe something more practical. When you go out to harvest plants on the landscape, you need something to put them in. You're not going to put a pile of blueberries in your pocket or just carry greens in your hands because, for example, with the greens, we want to stop them from wilting. Now, you can certainly use a plastic bag or a plastic container. Those work really, really well. We're wicked plastic phobes. We just don't like our food touching plastic. And, of course, we can't eliminate it 100% from our life. But we've done a good job getting rid of a lot of it. So what we've done is actually created bark containers. And try to imagine bark from a tree that's been folded in such a way to make a small bucket. And that bucket, because it's solid and it actually has a watertight layer on the inside of it, which would be the inner bark, works as a great container for collecting all kinds of wild foods, and it actually prevents desiccation. They don't wilt because it's essentially like a plastic container in not allowing moisture to pass through it. So these are things that we like to craft from our landscape, from wild plants that we'll use in other aspects of our living.
Ideal. Now, another question that came up is when we were talking about canning. Now, when you say canning, do you mean putting into metal containers or glass containers?
Into glass containers, and then using a hot water bath to essentially sterilize those foods so that pathogens can't grow in them, yes.
Yeah, the old-fashioned type of canning, I suppose, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. Most people are familiar with companies like Ball and Mason, Mason jars and Ball jars, that are used for canning. We've moved away from those particular brands because the lids that they have now are lined with a BPA-containing plastic, so it's something that's not good to be contacting with your food. And so we're using a particular European company called Weck that produces a glass jar with a glass lid.
Oh, right.
But all of those things work really well. And like I said, we really love canning meats, particularly imagine the cuts of the animal, like the neck and the front part of the animal. That aren't necessarily the most tender cuts, like portions of the hind and tenderloin in those places. And once it gets canned, because it's a prolonged heating, it's as soft as anything you've ever had. So it really makes for great textured meat.
You mentioned deer as a source of meat. What other animal do you use as a protein source?
We use a wide variety of animals, and it includes wild and domesticated animals. I mean, our freezer has beef and lamb and also mutton, the older lamb, you know, chicken and duck. And so we're really don't turn away many animal foods. For us, the biggest question is how were those animals raised? And we're interested in that. For the well-being of the animal, and of course for our well-being, because animals that are not fed biologically appropriate foods get sick, and then they simply don't support our health as well. But when it comes to the wild animals, things that we use here, white-tailed deer, moose, which is a huge, huge deer that can weigh upwards of a half a ton. When we're lucky, we can acquire bear, black bear in this part of the world, which is a wonderful meat. Trout, salmon, smelts, these are all fish that we gather. We occasionally get to gather various shellfish like soft shell clams. And then some birds. I occasionally hunt things like ruffed grouse, wild turkey, and even some species of waterfowl like mallards, black ducks, wood ducks, and things like that. Those are probably the ones that we have access to the most. And a few rodents even, like beaver, muskrat, and woodchuck, which might not sound that wonderful, but they actually have very tender and wonderful meat.
I'm personally a big fan of chocolate mousse.
You and me both.
Well, In Texas, they have a particular way of getting food. It's called roadkills.
And we utilize that as well. If there are particular roads near our home that we might have driven, say, the day before we came back from someplace and we're heading out again and we notice that there's something there, in other words, it's fresh, the weather has been cool, so we don't have to worry about, you know, the sort of rotting of meats and things, we've picked up whole wild turkey. I've even collected an entire deer before, and these are animals that may have only been struck in the head. The meat is perfectly intact, and all you have to do is overcome essentially a cultural inhibition for using these kinds of foods. I mean, there's really no difference in some ways between the bullet killing the animal and the car killing the animal. They both cause trauma to the animal, they take its life, and so long as both of those things happened recently, they can be really wonderful food. So when we notice those, we take them.
Excellent.
Good. Arthur, can you give us more information about what you do, your website, your classes, your institute, so on and so forth?
I guess that if people wanted to connect with me in some way and they wanted to learn a little bit more about what I do, they should go to my website, which is just arthurhaines.com. It's my name with no spaces, dots, or dashes in it. And there they can see my YouTube channel they can connect to, or to Facebook, any of those places that, you know, would allow people to either watch or read more of what I do. You know, I do a fair amount of writing. I try to keep them short, blogs on philosophy around food, health, and awareness, sustainability, and all of those can be found on the blog on my website. I have a newsletter that goes out that people can sign up for. I send it out very infrequently, maybe 3 or 4 times a year, to make sure I'm not flooding people's inbox with all kinds of unwanted, you know, mail. But any starting at my website, I think, would be a good place for people to go. I'm actually having it completely redone right now, so there'll be a new format within the month that I think people will really like. But that's where I'd begin.
Excellent.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're doing, you're a very busy man, and you're doing a great service to all of us. And I wish you good luck in your continuation of your work and educating people into, you know, wildcrafting and foraging and hunting.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys inviting me to be part of what you're doing as well, which looks wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was great.
That's been thoroughly enjoyable and very interesting too. Thank you, Arthur.